Pro Con Show with Hannah DeBlantis right here on 720 WGN. All right, now, this story that has developed over the last couple of days in Aurora, I think has it's reignited an interest in a decades-old story from Chicago that is one of the bloodiest and creepiest murder sprees ever in this city. And what's interesting is it kind of reintroduces this story that even in the 1980s, because it happened right after the Dahmer case, and then in the shadows, the arrests were made in the shadows of the ongoing Tylenol investigation, it didn't get the kind of attention that it probably would have gotten now, without question. Chrissy Gutowski from the Tribune has been following this story now for the last, crazy number of years, right? Is that correct?
I'm not quite old enough to have been a reporter in the early 1980s, but probably since the late 90s, I've been on it for some of the appeals, and of course the clemency hearing is when I first met several families of the Ripper Crew's victims.
So the Ripper Crew was four guys.
Correct.
And two brothers, right? Mm-hmm. The Cucurella's brothers. And they were the I guess, is it the elder brother that, or I don't know which one's older than which, but the one of the brothers was executed, last human executed by the state of Illinois in 1999, right?
Exactly 20 years ago, last month, yep.
And he was executed for these crimes, for the conviction of these crimes. And his brother has now been released. And explain how that happened, because there were as many as 17 murders related to this, right?
Correct. There's some mysteries about this horrible sexual sadistic killing spree of these four men, and one of them is just how many victims they did. But the authorities have placed it at about 17, and then a man as well, one man and 17 women. And Tommy Cucurella's, the three were arrested in late 1982, and Tommy was not arrested until a few months later. He basically walked up to a couple of the cops who were canvassing his neighborhood in Villa Park. The Cucurella's boys were from Villa Park in DuPage, and said, hey, I heard you got my brother. What's going on? So they began interviewing him, and he confessed to being present at a few of them.
So wait, I want to go back through this.
Yeah.
So his brother had already been scooped up by the police,
yep,
along with these two other guys, including one who was said to be sort of the ringleader of this.
Robin Gedd.
Right, yeah, and then
who was married with three children and had some sort of a satanic cult-worshipping place, altar in his attic or somewhere
and
in his house.
He was the Chicago connection, yeah, and he worked for John Wayne Gacy, which is confirmed. Gacy was listed on a witness list in a DuPage County court file that went through. So at some point he worked for Gacy, so this case is
That's
crazy
amazing.
Connections.
It's amazing that creepy. That would be. So this guy, and we'll get to Robin Gedd in a second, because I think it kind of all starts with him. And then there's a Spetzer guy?
Eddie Spreitzer.
Yeah. Spreitzer, and what did... How did all these guys know each other? Obviously, the brothers knew each other, but how did they...
Sure. Let me answer your first question, though. So the reason why Tommy Cucurella's got out is a DuPage County jury convicted him, and he got natural life. But a First District Appellate Court reversed it in 86, citing, legal errors. Basically, he confessed to a few of them, but his brother and Eddie Spreitzer also confessed and did not implicate him. And his defense attorney wanted those confessions to come in, showing that he didn't implicate him, and the judge ruled it was hearsay, so didn't allow it at his trial. And the higher court ruled that that was a reversible error. So he got a new trial, and on the eve of the trial, he decided to plead guilty instead of going to trial, and they gave him a 70-year sentence, and that was before truth in sentencing. So convicted murderers back in the day could get day-for-day good credit behind bars. In the early 90s, they switched that, and murderers no longer get good credit. So that's how he got out. He was a good boy behind bars.
50%, 36 years. And
correct.
He's out. He's a low IQ individual, is the way he's been described. Is that
75 was what he tested, which at the time they said was about higher than 4% of the nation's population, borderline mentally impaired.
Mm. which might explain why he went up to the police and said, "You've got my brother. What's going on with that?" And then they, so the police grab him up, and this again is in, this would be early 1983, right, when they arrested him.
Yeah, like November 82. So okay. Right in that all time right. period where all those crazy crimes are going on that you mentioned.
Right, and this when they were grabbing these guys up. And the thing is that I think that, that police at that point, from these murders started in 1981. Right.
That was 17-month crime spree. They believe the earliest victim was May of 81.
So from 1981 to 1982, you had these, and police were not necessarily connecting all of them, right?
It was strange because they had the women who they targeted didn't seem to have a lot of interconnectivity. They were different races, different professions. They were found in different places. They were picked up in the middle of the day. They were all kinds of neighborhoods, suburbs. Everywhere.
Right. There was no rhyme or reason.
The one thing was that they were alone, right? The women were alone.
They were alone, and they were targeting women who worked as prostitutes and minorities in the city in the beginning, and then they just began scooping up any sort of crime of opportunity, any lone woman walking down the street, day, night, city, suburbs. There was no rhyme or reason, and it was...
the bodies would be found in a mutilated state. Right, and they had been sexually assaulted, the bodies mutilated, and mutilated along that sort of sexual line as well.
Very sexually sadistic and cruel, and oftentimes they mutilated. It was part of like a satanic ritual that they did, as Anna mentioned, in the ringleader's home later with the body parts. But normally they mutilated them sexually and believed when some of the victims were alive.
So he protested his innocence, Robin Geck, in some famous letter that he wrote to a reporter. I mean, there had to be a ton of DNA evidence and a ton of evidence if they're involved in this kind of a crime. Is that right? Should we assume that?
So there really wasn't physical evidence against these guys at the time. This was right before DNA. You know, we know DNA was around for like Jeanine Nicarico a few years later, but this was like right before it. And it was just old fashioned, you know, shoe leather, gum shoe reporting, and it was confessions. Shockingly, as the ringleader, is the only one who was not convicted of a murder. He's the only one who didn't confess. So he's in until he's like 89, 2042, he gets out, if he lives that long, for attacking an 18-year-old woman who survived and identified him.
Oh,
that's how the whole thing unraveled, right? It was this one case of him, and it's a grievous attack. I mean, when you read the details of what he did to this woman, it is crazy. And he left her thinking she was going to die, right? Is that what we can assume?
Right. Because she's never talked publicly except for at his trial, and they tried to get her to talk in the clemency hearings. And a DuPage County prosecutor, who's a good source, called her and asked her, "Would you appear before the Prison Review Board?" And he was told, "You'll never know how much this phone call upset me. Don't call here again." Still just can't talk about it.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, based on what the criminal report is, you can sort of understand it. She... like many of these victims, I mean, these guys were literally focusing on the sexual organs as a mutilation point. And again, as you pointed out, while these women were still alive. And I think the bodies, now this is the interesting piece of this, is that they would, and one of the reasons that they were having trouble tracking, because some of it was in DuPage County, some of it was in Cook County, some of it was in the city of Chicago, some of it was in the suburbs of Cook County.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is another era, and this is right on the verge of those kinds of things being data coordinated, were not.
Yeah.
So you had different police agencies looking at things and not necessarily coordinating this you know, practice modus operandi. And the two of the bodies were disposed of in Chicago, one at Division and Lakeshore Drive, right?
One of them was a Broadview woman, I think you're talking about.
Advertising executive or something.
Yeah, I mean, she was at an appointment. In
middle of the day kind of thing, broad daylight.
Yeah, walking back to her car, and they just grabbed her. And that, when it happened, like in the Gold Coast community and in the heart of downtown and suburbs, that's when people started taking a little more note.
Right.
And in broad daylight.
Retired police officer who I reached out to, who was on that case, and he remembers it well, based on basically the brutality of it. And, you know, at the time, that was just, it was something that stood out in their minds and still haunts him to this day.
And I think as anyone who knows this case, I grew up in the Chicago area, it affected, like, when I walk to my car you know, Lori Borowski was abducted broad daylight in a shopping center walking to work on a spring Saturday morning. I think women know from this case, always be conscious if you see, especially vans. I never park near vans with those sliding doors.
I like that too.
Yeah. I mean, it really awoke a consciousness, as many of these cases do in all of us in the area.
So let's get to where we stand now today. All right, so you've got this horrifying, up to 17 victims. The details, some of them have emerged in the reporting, your reporting in the Tribune, Christy, but also in other stories around this. And today, in researching this, we talked to a number of different attorneys who are involved in this, people at Cook County State's Attorney's Office and other people.
Yep, some are around still.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, we just had a lawyer in a totally different story who said, yeah, I was on felony review for that. Four people I've talked to independently today have all said, oh my God, you're not going to believe how sick this was, because they went through, and I think a lot of people were also in a different era of the state attorney's office where you'd go and could read other people's cases. Now that's frowned upon now, and there's a data track to it. But these guys were getting the case files on it because they couldn't believe what these four guys were doing to these women. I mean, it is horrifying. I mean, it's the worst. It's the worst nightmarish thing you can imagine if you're a woman. And there's a sense now, as this Cocorella's brother has been returned to society, when the details of that are out, that's why you're getting protests in Aurora.
And we'll never exactly know his involvement. He admitted to being present but not taking part in the rapes or the murders of any of the women. But he admitted to being present to three of them. And then he later changed his story at trial and said that the details were fed to him by these detectives. But I will tell you, some of the detectives on the case, it doesn't hold water with me, because one was John Milner, who became the Elmhurst police chief and a longtime state senator. And another was John Sam, who was a bit of a hero in the Nicarico saga. Mm-hmm. Shortly later, quit his job in protest because he was unhappy with the Orlando Cruz arrest. And he is held out in amongst organizations that do wrongful convictions and exonerations as a good cop. So that doesn't hold water to me. Mm-hmm. And the cops say if we did, he wasn't bright enough to have remembered everything. So
right, they were trying to talk him into something, to talk him into a confession.
Right, yeah. But he does appear to be out of them the one that may have been the least most involved. It was interesting, though. I found a juror from his 84 trial, I think it was, in DuPage, and she was kind of in charge of the evidence, and she told me that, like, he admitted in his confession to opening the door of a hotel room where one of the women was taken. So, to her, that's culpability. You did nothing. You're just as guilty as the others.
Christy, hold on one second. Christy Gutowski is with us from the Chicago Tribune. We'll talk more about this and also get the reaction from what's going on in Aurora, as people are outraged by the fact that this guy involved in these murders, at whatever level, but still involved in the murders, and the brother of a guy who's executed for the murders is now free and is living in a religious kind of halfway house kind of situation in Aurora, and we'll explain exactly what that's all about on the other side. But first, Kim, what's coming up at the bottom of the hour?
Roe devastated again, that from the family of Timothy Pitson after hearing the Aurora boy wasn't found after all.
Bro Con Show with Anna DeVlantis right here on 720 WGN. There's a story here in Chicago that is just now capturing national attention because of the way it has developed over the last couple of days. And it's an old story. It goes back to the 1980s, early 1980s, 81 and 82. Yeah. Series of murders here. It was the Ripper Crew was who they were, was how police referred to them when they were making the arrests. And it was four guys that lived. One of them lived in Chicago, and then the others were in the suburbs. And they were traveling throughout the Chicago metropolitan area. And this is one of the reasons that it took so long to detect them, because back in that era, there wasn't really that connection, because they were working DuPage County and Cook County, the city of Chicago, and the suburbs. And they were abducting women in a van. sexually mutilating them, leaving their bodies, in some cases, you know, in alleyways, another time thrown off a bridge, the bridge over the Chicago River at Fullerton.
Yeah.
And these bodies were mutilated in such a way that these guys were then taking body parts as tokens back to a satanic altar at one of the guy's houses, in the guy who lived in Chicago at his house, and doing unspeakable things there as well. And it's a house of horrors story.
It is.
And one of the people in this was executed. He was the last person executed in the state of Illinois in 1999.
Another one was commuted to life by Governor Ryan when he was on death row, was sentenced to death.
And then another may be released when he's 89 years old. That's 2042. He's still got 23 years left before that happens. But the fourth person in this case has been released. And now he is living in Aurora. And he just arrived there in the last couple of days. Christy Gutowski has been covering this story for a long time for the Chicago Tribune, and she joins us right now. She's been here telling us a story. And Dr. Matt Harrington lives in Aurora, and he is mounting a protest against this person coming to. Thomas Cocorellis is his name, being able to live in this kind of a halfway house kind of facility, a religious organization doing a halfway house kind of facility. And I'm not quite sure they're saying, if you read what they're the statement of this particular organization, Wayside Cross Ministries, is that they're doing God's work. You know, this is a person who wants to turn his life around. They're going to help him turn his life around. He's paid his debt to society. So just leave him alone. And Dr. Harrington, you look at this differently.
Oh, yes. Thank you for having me on this evening. I really appreciate it because this story needs to get out even more because it's relative. This person, as you know, went around with a satanic cult, kidnapped, then used an ice pick on a lot of their victims, up to 80 punctures in a person. They severed their left breast to use in a satanic cult, killed them, and then raped them. Right? Let's repeat that. Killed them, and then raped them. These people are animals. It's not just when, but he's going to do this again if out. And Aurora, the mayor says, was blindsided by having this person here. Well, that's a total canard. Because the mayor knew that this guy was coming here, and that's why he was on vacation. And then he got called out on it because we found out. And we're starting this protest tomorrow at 11 o'clock at Wayside Ministries. And we'll then march from Wayside Ministries to City Hall to make sure that they know that we don't want this rapist and murderer here. Endangering our community, because once he's past their 30-day wait period, he's able to walk out at any time of that halfway house and go find a job or just smell the flowers. Well, we have a nice river path that goes from Aurora all the way up to St. Charles and down to Montgomery. That whole community is in danger by this guy. And let's not forget, these people were working with John Wayne Gacy because the van was John Wayne Gacy's van.
That's actually not accurate, but one of the guys in this, Robin Gecht, was an electrician who did work on projects with John Wayne Gacy. We know that's confirmed,
right.
but the van is not his. But there are I mean, this is an issue when people are returned to the community after, you know, being criminals. Does this organization, this Christian organization, do they have a right to try to rehabilitate him? He's paid his debt to society, theoretically.
Well, no, he actually didn't pay his debt. He was supposed to be in there for 75 years, and the Greek Orthodox Church came in and had his sentence reduced by 40 years.
That's not true either.
He served 50% of his time because there was no truth in sentencing at that time. He was sentenced to 70 years, and so he served 50%, which is what most anybody
did.
Who was sentenced at that time did.
But, all right, so, okay. So the protest, though, What do you if this organization doesn't change what they're going to do? What is your plan?
Well, our plan is to also force an ordinance through the city here, which we've been trying to push for several years, of electronic monitoring of all violent sexual predators that come into our area. I mean, if we could do it for DUI people, we could do it for the most heinous, and recidivism is the highest on sexual predators, over 60% nationally, that they will commit the crime again.
All right.
So we have to start using technology for our benefit, because as a small community of 209,000 people, with a police force, really, I only have about 36 officers on the street at any one shift. And right now, we're down 4% of our police officers because of the Henry Platt shooting. We need to start looking forward and being more progressive and proactive versus and always saying, oh, we didn't know. Oh, we're going to trust this person, because that doesn't work.
All right. Matt, thank you very much. Appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Christy, want a couple clarifications here, obviously. I think we did them in real time. But obviously there's a lot of emotion here, and this is an era in which emotion and sometimes things that are not 100% true get played out in these. But it's still, you can understand what's going on in this town, which is that this is a very scary time, because when you stop and you take this in sum total, what these four guys did, and it's very unclear who did what when in this whole process, right, between these four guys. It does appear that this particular guy, the lowest IQ guy, and, you know, may have only been present for some of this as opposed to all 17, but it's still, he's been convicted of a murder.
Correct. He's pled guilty to it. He was convicted, then it got reversed, and he did plead guilty to it. It was interesting. We've been reporting about, he was originally supposed to get out in September of 2017, mm-hmm. but he had no place to go. And because he's not a registered sex offender, people keep saying that, but he is a convicted murderer who is committed a sexually motivated murder. So he has to, under an Illinois state law, register on the sex offender registry. But that's all he has to do. He can live within 500 feet of a school or a park or a daycare. So he had 3 days to stay where he was going. He was released from a prison in West Central Illinois on Friday.
Near Galesburg, right?
Yeah, he told them he was going to Wheaton. Mm-hmm. So that was what was reported Friday and Saturday. And even the state police website said on Wheaton, said Wheaton homeless on Saturday, and then Sunday morning he walked into the Aurora Police Department and registered with Wayside, which is a wonderful ministry that does great work in Aurora. But obviously people did feel blindsided and are very fearful.
So the mayor was probably truly blindsided. We just heard from Matt that maybe not, but like everyone else, thought he was going to Wheaton.
He was going to Wheaton. Wheaton put out a press release on Saturday saying we haven't heard from him, and people in Wheaton were, you know, there's these Facebook
concerned.
Mom pages and stuff. People were lit up. So, it was a shock to people when he ended up in Aurora.
He's given an interview with someone who's in the Tribune family of newspapers and said, I just want to be left alone. I'm not a risk. I don't have any plans. I don't want anybody to, I just don't want to have any contact with victims or anybody else. I just want to go on with God and go on with my life.
Correct. So he's 58 years old, and we know because he received day for day credit that he stayed out of trouble in prison these past 35 years. We know that he's done some ministry in prison, but we don't know, for example, if he's still claiming innocence or if he has admitted to his part and showed any sort of remorse. Mm-hmm. We know he did not have a violent history before this happened, but he admitted he had a rough life. His mom died when he was 17 in his arms. His father was a cook and worked many jobs to support the family, big family. And we know that he was special ed, dropped out of high school pretty early, and he got involved in, I think it was cocaine that he admitted, according to the court files.
Well, it's interesting because his brother seems to have been the lead bad guy in all
of
this.
Yes, Andrew Cocorellis.
And was executed, right? Last person to be executed in the state of Illinois. But that doesn't, I mean, I don't, if I lived in that community, I wouldn't feel any better about that. I mean, let's just be honest. I mean, he's admitted to being a part of this group. He knows what they were doing,
right?
And they and you know, it's even 36 years later, I would not Phil Berry is 58 years old. He's still, you know,
very much so. And I think his point about I don't want any contact with the families came from some the Lorianne Borowski's family had a press conference last week, and they had Gloria Allred came in from Los Angeles, and they want to propose some, you know, amendment to the
Lori's
sex offender.
Right?
Yeah, about
what would that do?
No, well, I don't know how well thought out it is, frankly, since he's not a registered convicted sex offender, but a no contact order they want in place for any victim's families.
And the only reason he's not a convicted sex offender is because all of the legal machinations that happened.
Correct.
Because of, you know, he was originally tried. He was tried with his brother on a single jury, right? Wasn't that the case?
He was convicted of a rape, though, but that got reversed, and then just to make for the plea deal, they just he just pled guilty to straight murder, not the rape part.
Got it.
But
all right.
The law changed later.
Right. And this was all, and again, you know, you're getting caught in that niche where law, technology, all those things.
Right.
Changed between the late 1970s and the mid 1980s, and it was a totally different world after that. And he's been the beneficiary of the day for day, and the beneficiary of you know a review. And then there wasn't enough DNA to be able. There was no DNA at that point used in these cases. So there are a lot of happenstance things that have occurred here that have now allowed Thomas Coccarellis to be free at the age of 58. And the community is, we find ourselves in this moment where community is scared. And as you heard from Matt Arrington, outraged.
Mm-hmm. And there's family members who live nearby. I mean, Lorianne Borowski's mother said, I would never imagined in my lifetime that he would get out.
All right. Thank you. Christy Kotowski from the Chicago Tribune.
Great
appreciate
reporting.
You being with us for the last hour talking about this. Let's check in with Andre Darlis. What's coming up at the top of the hour?
Well, Roe Jussie Smollett isn't paying, but the city of Chicago isn't giving up just yet. That's coming up at 7:00.